Make sure you're in fellowship here then, and continue on here, dealing with Jesus' entry into Jerusalem. And now his late evening look around at the temple. We left off here, we're ready to go on with point 24 of verse 11. Jesus entered Jerusalem and came into the temple. And after looking around at everything, and that's where we're up to the verb here, periblepo, to look around is used several times in Mark. When Jesus is the subject, Mark only uses it to deal with doctrinally significant events. In other words, he's looking around for an apparent doctrinal reason that there is something going on that has arrested his attention, and he wants to make sure that everybody knows. So in a sense, when the disciples saw this, what their question should have been was, why is he looking around this way? What's the purpose of this? Now, they didn't necessarily ask that, but Mark 3:5, here we saw when the guy was here with the guy with the withered hand, and after looking around at them with anger, in that case, of course, the looking around is a slight form of judgment, expressing his hostility to the negative volition of the Pharisees who were present there. And also verse 34, same chapter, looking around at those. This is when his mother and his brothers come, and they are determined that Jesus has lost his mind and that they are there to deliver him because he's no longer stable. And when they try to force their will on him, he resists. Again, verse 31, his mother and brothers arrived, and standing outside, they sent word to him. Might not appear to be significant from the English, but the reality of it is they had taken their stand outside. They weren't going in. They were trying to force him to respond to them. And so, here, verse 34, looking around at those who were sitting around him, he said, you know, answering the question, who, your mother and your brothers are outside to see you? Well, let's talk about relationships now. Let's talk about the relationships that matter. Those of positive volition and not those of our earthly families. Also, 5:32, he used it. This was when the woman with the 12-year hemorrhage was pressed in on him. And he looked around to see the woman who had done this. And again, this is all, obviously, the looking around here has a very distinct purpose, and that is to identify the culprit, as it were. And then it's used in 10:23, which we saw not all that long ago. And this was following the departure of the rich young ruler, and Jesus looking around. When he looks around like this, it's designed to draw people's attention to the fact that he's taking in the situation and considering it from a doctrinal perspective. And that's precisely what you would read into it here. And not read into it, but what it actually means is that looking around, he is sizing the situation up. And from a doctrinal perspective, he's seeking to determine what it is he wants to do and what it is that needs to be done. So 25, therefore, what actually happens here is the fulfillment of the prophecy in Malachi. Jesus is the Lord that has come into his temple. Malachi 3:1. But again, how many people, one, were even present for this and had any appreciation for it? Well, the answer, how many had appreciation for it, is none other than Jesus himself. And here we are on a Monday evening towards dark, and Malachi 3:1 is fulfilled. And the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come into his temple. And here he is. And nobody knows him. Nobody recognizes that he's the Lord of the temple. Now, one of the things we're going to see is when he addresses this issue in the temple on the next day, he essentially takes the verse that's applied to God and claims to apply it to himself. In verse 17 of Mark, is it not written, my house will be called a house of prayer? Well, obviously that referred to God's house in the initial statement out of Isaiah. But you have made it into a robber's den. And Jesus is essentially claiming ownership of this house along with God. Well, as God, of course, it is his house. But as the son of David, he's not in the priesthood, so he doesn't have the right to make that claim. That claim can only come from his deity. So it is his house. Well, 26, thus, he has the right to evaluate the temple and its activities. It is his temple. He is qualified to inspect the scene form an opinion about the temple operations and those responsible for them, make a righteous judgment about it all, and exercise that judgment. And this is a part of authority. And this is where people need to understand that authority is there for a reason. And when authorities function within the boundaries and parameters of their authority, these types of judgments are necessary from time to time. I haven't met very many authorities that really liked judging in a harsh sense or in a strict sense. There's probably people out there like that. But anyone who understands biblical authority and the nature of the responsibility of having authority, I haven't met very many people that just said, oh, I delight in judging things and having to pass judgment on certain issues. You don't, but you have to. And failure to do that as an authority and make the proper judgments and then enforce them is on you. It's on you as a failure. If you have authority, you have it for a reason. And from time to time, sadly, whether you like it or not, you're going to have to exercise it. And I've seen people with this laissez-faire approach to authority, and that is not biblical. It is not biblical to be an authority and say, well, that goes on, but there's nothing I can do about it. Well, if you're the authority, yeah, there is. There very often is something you can do about it. Number one, the very minimum, you could address it and say, hey, this is inappropriate. But there may be a time and a place where you have to make judgments on things. And while I don't delight in passing judgment on people, I recognize it goes with the territory. And so Jesus has this authority, and he has to exercise it, and he has to exercise it properly. So one of the things you see here, he doesn't do anything rash. He doesn't just wade in there that night and just go to town on them. Number one, there's other reasons for that, we're going to find out. But number two, this shows that he's thoughtful. Well, 27, another obvious fact here is that Jesus is observed being very thoughtful and calculating, considering his task carefully, doing nothing rationally, and making his plans for the next day. So this is a good point. If you are an authority, don't do things rashly. Stop and think through it. Because even as an authority, there are going to be things in life that tick you off. And whether rightly or wrongly so. Sometimes they may tick you off from a human perspective, and you're not supposed to deal with it. That is an authority factor you have to learn how to deal with. And then other times, it's ticking you off because God wants you to take action. How does God motivate authorities for action? Things have to upset them. And when things upset them, don't presume they're wrong just because they're upset. They may be upset because they should be upset. And that's, again, the nature of authority, and you want to handle this thing properly if you've got any sort of authority. And the goal of you having authority at any level is so that those under your authority are benefited in terms of God and his plan. It's not just for you to have authority. It's for you to be able to, in certain ways, provide help for people. Where they may not know it, where they may not need it, or where they do need it, but they may not know that they need it, is what I'm trying to say. And so, again, authority is not used, you know, I've never felt at all that authority is for the purpose of making you feel bad or for making you do things or attempting to bend you to my will. The only, essentially, as I understand it, the only reason for authority is to seek to bend you to God's will. Now, that is why authority is there. And guess what? All of us need authority because we don't all always bend to God's will like we should, do we? Oh, I do, but, you know, I think some of the rest of you don't. No, I don't either. And so that's another good reason, you know, for why does God give people authority who are sinful and who fall short themselves? Well, to me, it tempers your judgment. It tempers your willingness while something may tick you off and you may react to it, and maybe rightly so, that it's a doctrinal deviation of some sort or whatever, and it may tick you off, your response should be tempered and conditioned with the fact that you need grace and that you fail and that you have done stupid stuff. And so you're not so quick just to jump in the middle of everything and stomp all over it because you got authority to do so. You want to exercise your authority thoughtfully, hopefully. Jesus does that. He manifests this here very carefully. He makes his plans for the next day. He comes in. He's really quite low-key about all of this. Now, he will not be in the morning. The next morning, low-key is out the window. Now he's going to take that authority, and he's going to use it. And it's not going to be a pretty sight, and they're not going to like it. Now, that's another whole issue you have to deal with as a person in authority. People under your authority aren't always going to like the way you exercise your authority. And in some cases, it may be because of abuse. And in other cases, it may not be at all because of abuse. It may just be they don't like it. And again, my expression I've used a lot, and most people don't mind authority until it's exercised. And it's when the authority says, hey, you know, you need to think about this. Because nobody really likes being rebuked. It's not a fun thing. Or reproved, you know, being told, hey, you know, you're wrong about this. You need to address this. This viewpoint you've got is incorrect. It does not square with Scripture or this action you're performing or whatever it may be. So as an authority, you know, you fail, you fall short, you need grace. Well, that to me tempers how you're going to treat other people. So 28, it is clear that he makes certain of his facts before taking action on the following day. His actions, as many have noted, are not simply the result of emotional outrage, but a demonstration of power and authority that was planned to gain maximum attention and have maximum impact. And the fact is, when people are rejecting and rebelling against authority, they're never going to like it no matter what you do. I've observed that as people go negative. I've seen it over the years as they begin to substitute human viewpoint and reject certain doctrines and think, well, I can get away with this. I don't have to apply this doctrine. I don't have to submit to authority. I don't have to separate. I don't have to attend class regularly. I don't have to do these things. And they substitute other viewpoints and all of that. Well, then ultimately there's going to be a conflict. And I remember one time I asked this one person, they said, you know, they came to me and said, it doesn't seem like you get along with me very well. I said, well, I wonder why that is. I said, do you buy the doctrine of separation? Do you apply it in your life? Well, no. Yeah, well, we're going to be great friends. We'll hang out all the time. Me and you, we get together with your negative friends and the people that aren't even saved or that you socialize with. And yeah, let's just get together and have a lot of fun. Well, no. Yeah, you're going to be at odds with an authority who's actually practicing the doctrine and who applies it even when it's difficult. And yeah, you're going to be at odds. And I just told him that. I said, how do you expect to have fellowship when we don't agree? Can two walk together except they be agreed? No, not effectively. That's not going to ever work. And while you know, as an authority, or at least as a spiritual authority, I don't have any desire to separate from anybody, frankly. Most of the time, like I said, it's done for you if you're applying doctrine and taking it seriously. They're not going to want to hear about the truth. If you're articulating the divine viewpoint, you'll run negative volition off. You can't help it because they can't stand the heat. So they get out of the kitchen, the doctrinal kitchen, they leave. So here the whole point of this is if you're going to have a fellowship with Jesus, you better understand what it is he wants, what his views are, and all that. Same as if you're going to have fellowship with other people. But John essentially says, if you look in 1 John chapter 1, John effectively addresses this. Verse 3, what we have seen and heard, we proclaim to you also, so that you too may have fellowship with us. Again, if you don't accept our views on these matters, we're not going to have fellowship. That's pretty evident from what John's saying here. And indeed, our fellowship was with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. So basically, John tells these people flat out, if you don't adhere to the doctrine that I'm teaching you, you're not going to not only have fellowship with me, you're not going to have fellowship with God. Because let's assume for a second that a sinful person can actually represent God. Well, I'm kind of hoping they can. Either that or all the apostles were in trouble. And every pastor that's ever lived. And in fact, then we'd have to say, well, only Jesus can truly represent God. But that's not true. God has had his plan in human history, and so little of it has revolved around having the God-man on the planet that that literally lasted for 35 years or less out of the entire course of human history. And yet God manages to represent his plan through sinful prophets, through sinful men like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, David, Solomon, Paul, James, John, Peter, Ron, right on down the road. And yet God manages to do just fine, thank you very much. He does not say, oh my God. He looks over at Jesus. Do you know that our plan is down to Ron? And then they start freaking out. What are we going to do? That's not like I'm the only representative of the truth. I'm not. But the point is that, look, you could point out anybody. And so most of the time, God's plan has not been represented by God. It's been represented by sinful men. I mean, at least on planet Earth. And so here, John says, essentially, if you don't want to adhere to the doctrine and you don't want to fellowship with us, you're not actually fellowshipping with the Father and the Son either. So be clear on that. When you blow off doctrine and you blow off your spiritual authority, you're blowing off God. You're not just blowing me off. And that was one of the things, obviously, as a communicator, we have feelings. We're human. You know, last time I checked, I am not a robot or an alien. But you see it, say, even in Samuel. Back then when the Jews demanded a king, Samuel was ticked off. He was mad. And the Lord says, all right, don't be mad. Because they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. And you got to recognize that this isn't on you. And so as a certain level, as an authority, a spiritual authority, you have to recognize these people are literally dealing with God, whether they know it or not. And that's the reality of it. Well, 29 here, Mark is the only writer to note that Jesus arrived late in the day on Monday and draws attention to the fact by stating that it was already late, by placing the phrase, opsiase de huses, later being already, forward for emphasis. And 30, what should be clear is that the physical hour was not only late. The prophetic hour for Israel was very late as well. Although the king has suddenly come into his temple, is it too late? And the answer is yes, it is. It's too late. And not through any fault of his own, through the negative volition of the Jews. It's too late. For some people, spiritually, it's already too late. They've crossed the line of demarcation. They've gone past the point of no return. And for them, they're all but done. Now, they'll live out their lives as believers, lacking fellowship, lacking true fellowship with God, lacking orientation to his plan, and will eventually probably die the sin unto death. Because I don't know, you know, again, what's in between dying grace and the sin unto death? I don't know what's in there. I mean, either I want to me, you either go out under dying grace or you're going out ignominiously. And if I'm going to go out absent the rapture, I want to go out under dying grace. I don't want to go out as ashamed, as a believer that blew off God's plan, who deserves to be killed, frankly. I want to be of the oriented sheep, even though, you know, we're all like sheep destined for the slaughter. But at least we're oriented to it. That's the good thing. Well, what should be clear is that the hour was not only late. Well, 31, since it was late in the day and the city gates closed at sundown, Jesus takes the 12 and withdraws from Jerusalem to Bethany, where we know he had supporters. John 11:1 talks about the village of Bethany with Lazarus and Mary and Martha. We know that they had, and in fact, this family appears. This is an interesting deal, too, I want to point out here. He tells, like, say, the rich young ruler, I think I've mentioned this when we did this, he tells the rich young ruler to follow him, and Bartimaeus follows him. Well, Bartimaeus probably didn't have any good reason not to follow him. I mean, if you're a blind beggar, you probably don't have a lot of ties, you know, holding you down. Well, I'm going to have to leave my boat. You know, you're not probably concerned all that much with the details of life. You're basically probably living from day to day off of donations. But we see here that you have Lazarus and Mary and Martha. Well, he never tells them to leave their niche and follow him. It wasn't apparently God's will for them to do all that, where it was maybe for these other people. So there's the Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and Martha. And we also know that there was one Simon the leper. Again, I presume Simon the ex-leper. That was apparently amenable to Jesus, because he's the one that holds that big dinner. So Jesus has friends, as it were, in Bethany. By withdrawing to Bethany, point 32, where Jesus would stay every night until his betrayal, he put himself out of the reach of the Sanhedrin, lessened his profile among the masses, and still stayed close enough to Jerusalem to travel there daily. And the reality is, you might think, well, why would he have to leave the city? Isn't he safe? No, he's not safe. And in fact, the very first night he spends in Jerusalem after this entry, he's arrested. So do you think they wouldn't have arrested him Tuesday night or Monday night if they could have caught him? Or Tuesday or Wednesday? I think they would have. And I think Jesus knows they would have. Because the problem was they weren't considering, they didn't care about what the law said. They were going to commit murder and they knew it. At least the leadership of the Jews. Well, 33, although it is never mentioned specifically, it would make some sense that the donkey Jesus had commandeered was returned to its owner to Bethany, on the return trip, rather, to Bethany. I don't see Jesus, frankly, just taking the donkey and keep... Number one, the donkey's never mentioned again, so it fades into the background. But given the nature of the Lord and what I understand about grace and his righteousness, it wouldn't be right for him to keep that donkey. He didn't. Number one, he doesn't need it anymore. He only needed the donkey for that one little hour, as it were, however long it took, to get into Jerusalem. And then he doesn't need it anymore. So I'm presuming one of the apostles, maybe the two that went and got it, probably were told to, no, okay, take it back. Give it back to the owner. Well, verse 12 now, on the next day, when he had left Bethany, he became hungry. And as again, another chi that is not translated here. On the next day is the he, epaurion, definite article, H-E, E-P-A-U-R-I-O-N. He, epaurion. That's an adverb of time, the following day, the next day. Again, the aorist participle, after he had left Bethany, better than when. After they had left Bethany, when or after is fine, I guess. But all of this is a part of a genitive absolute clause. You'll notice here, but you won't notice, but unless you can read the parsing, that the verb the exerchomai is in the genitive along with everything that follows in this sentence except for the last verb. And so basically what, the genitive absolute is designed to provide additional information that's not grammatically really connected to the rest of the sentence. When, after he had left Bethany, the author didn't have to tell you that, but he does put it in, and so it's here in the genitive absolute clause. Having gone out, they, which presumably is Jesus and the 12, from, they is the third person of the pronoun autos, from Bethany, preposition apo, which is what you would expect. Again, spatially, here's Bethany, you go out from it. They're moving away from it. And then you've got the verb pinao, P-E-I-N-A-O, literally to feel hunger pangs. We've all been hungry. You may be hungry now. I don't know. If you had a snack on break, you shouldn't be, but you might be. So we all know what it's like to be hungry. Well, this is clearly only true of his humanity. God never gets hungry. God doesn't have to eat. So this is only true of his humanity. Seeing at a distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to see if perhaps he would find anything on it. And again, another chi not translated, having seen or after he saw, eidon, the aorist participle, after seeing, and then you got here the word suke, S-U-K-E. This is generic for any type of fig tree. It could, there's different types of fig trees, but the type of the fig tree really doesn't matter. I watch people get bogged down in things that really don't matter in terms of exegesis and teaching sheep. What difference does it make what kind of fig tree it was? It's a fig tree. So you got suke here. From a distance, preposition apo plus the verb makrothen, M-A-K-R-O-T-H-E-N, the adverb literally from afar or from a distance, having, present active participle, here an attendant circumstance, having phulon, foliage or leaves, P-H-U-L-L-O-N. Phulon's only used six times, it means that, leaves or foliage. He went, aorist indicative of the verb, erchomai, to go or to, went is fine here. He went, and they've supplied here what you don't have, and they've supplied it in the New American Standard, a complementary infinitive, which defines, you know, what he was doing, which that's fine in this case. This is actually a good insertion here. He went to see if, perhaps, you got the conditional particle EI, which normally is translated by if, and then you have this particle ara, A-R-A, used to denote something possible or conceivable, if perhaps or if possible. If possible, there was anything, accusative neuter singular of the indefinite pronoun tis, if there was something or anything, he will find. He will find is actually eurisko, and again, you would use a future here because from the standpoint of the narrative, Jesus is approaching the fig tree, and so he doesn't know if he's going to find anything, but that point is still future as the author conceives it. To see if he will find in it or on it, preposition in plus the locative of the feminine, by the way, because tree, that word fig rather is feminine. Fig tree is feminine, so therefore this saltos is feminine to match it grammatically, the tree. And having come, or once he approached it, and when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. And as Kai here, actually translated this time, having come, again a temporal participle, after he had come, upon it, or to it, preposition epi plus the accusative of altos, the tree, not one thing, nothing, udais is the adjective, literally not one, or not one thing, nothing, nothing he found, eurisko is the verb to find, upon it, except leaves. When he came to it, he found nothing except is the conjunction I may, or the construction. This is usually translated except or unless. He found nothing except phulon, again, leaves or foliage. And then Mark here introduces an explanatory clause for the season. It was not the season for figs. For the season is the definite article with kairos, and this means a period of time of unknown duration. It generally has to do with a strategic idea of a strategic period of time where something important happens. But season is a good way, and many times this word is translated by the term season in the New American Standard. That there's a particular time we know when fruit ripens, and the figs are no exception. So the season, the time of year, it was not, negative u plus the to be verb I me, it was not of figs. The time of figs, we would translate that the time for figs, which is fine. It's a genitive, but if you used an ablative here, and by the way, the ablative is the same form if you're using the other case system. Sukon is the word. There you saw that the term suke means fig tree, sukan, the fruit of the fig tree, i.e. figs. So it was not the season for figs. He said to it, may no one ever eat fruit from you again. And his disciples were listening. And Kai, he responded, literally having responded, again, this is very often not translated in many of the scripture translations, because you've got the verb apokrinomai, which means to respond, to make a judgment, a mental assessment of something from the facts at hand. So having made a mental judgment, he said, Jesus is the subject, of course, ipon, the aorist indicative, to it, again, a feminine here to match grammatically with tree, no longer is the adverb meketi, M-E-K-E-T-I, from now on or no longer, into the ages, translated here, ever, is the word they've translated. You got the prepositional phrase eis plus the term ion in the accusative singular, into the age. Actually, I thought it was plural, it's singular. Ever is fine, into the age, ever or forever. From you, preposition ek, out from you, off of you, preposition ek from plus the genitive of su. No one. Adjective again, may dice, the numeral heist with a negative may. No one, fruit, accusative singular, may eat. You have the aorist active optative of estio. You don't see a lot of optatives, estio, E-S-T-H-I-O, in the New Testament. There are some. But this is a voluntative optative often used to express a wish or prayer. The optative, very often that's the way it's used. It's used in the language of prayer because it's expressing what the speaker wants or wishes or desires to happen. but it's expressed in the form of a request. Now, in Jesus' case, when he says this, his request is viewed as a prophetic utterance on the tree. Because later on, if you look ahead in this, in verse 21, being reminded, Peter said to him, "Look, Rabbi, the fig tree which you cursed has withered." Now, the language of cursing is not used here, but Peter uses it as a way of expressing the view of those who saw this and their read on it. Was this, and this is very commonly called, and most commentaries, this is called the cursing of the fig tree. Although Jesus never uses the language of cursing. He just utters a prayer or wish. But Peter understands that wish as a curse on the fig tree. That this is what Jesus is getting at. "So may no one ever eat fruit from you again." And Kai were listening, imperfect active indicative of akouo, A-K-O-U-O. Now this is a simple verb to hear or listen. But the fact that it's an imperfect indicates they were hearing for a period of time. In other words, they were paying attention is even better here. His disciples were listening or even paying attention communicates what's going on here. That they caught this one. And probably this had to seem weird to them at some level. I mean, if you've been with Jesus for this time, 3 years plus now, how often have they ever seen Jesus lose his cool? Well, they saw it at the first cleansing of the temple. There was no doubt they were witnesses to that. It would appear. They were still, they had not been formally commissioned as apostles yet. But it would appear that those people that are introduced in John 1 are with him. And that they began to follow him at that time. Because they're going to stay in Jerusalem for some time. Because this is, again, the Feast of the Passover. They're there, and this is during the time where all this takes place with Nicodemus in John 3. And then on the return trip back to Galilee, where all of these guys lived, apparently, they went with him, and they were there at the woman of the well. So we know that the disciples saw this, the first cleansing of the temple. So they saw Jesus pretty angry and sort of freak out. Now, this is early on in the ministry. So they kind of, you probably had to wonder, wow, what, this is odd. I mean, if I think he's the Messiah, what's he doing here? Well, but most of the time when they've observed Jesus, you don't see Jesus losing his cool. And on the surface, it looks to me, and I think it looks to most interpreters here, like Jesus walks up to this fig tree, he doesn't get what he wants, and he throws a little temper tantrum. Now, that's how most people interpret it. That's only the way it appears on the surface. That's not what's going on here. Because, number one, Jesus was smarter than that. Number two, he was always in fellowship, so this isn't a little STA temper tantrum, a little snip fit, But they're paying attention to this, and they've heard him utter harsh language before. But it's generally been directed towards the religious leaders. Probably the harshest outside of that I can remember that he said was when he, told that poor Gentile woman she was a dog. That probably seemed harsh on the surface. But they're paying attention, and that's good. At least they're going to get this one, as we're going to see. Because I think, once again, when you have Peter articulating later on here, he's very much speaking for the group, as he often does. Well, point one, as we have observed in Mark's account, he does not place much emphasis on chronological matters, and most often introduces what he records without any chronological notation. Two, the fact that Mark chooses to be so specific during this last week of Jesus' life does allow us to fix the chronology for that final week. So we do know the good thing about this here is, for whatever reason now, Mark includes a bunch of chronological notes. Kind of beginning with the approach to Bethany, or to Jerusalem there, Jericho, I'm sorry. And then the approach to Bethany and then on into Jerusalem. Well, Jesus travels to Bethany on Sunday and has a meal at the home of Simon the leper. Again, Mark records that as a flashback in 14, but that corresponds with what occurs in John 12, where we're never really told in John 12 that it was at the house of Simon the leper, but I believe that there are subtle indications in the text that let you know that, number one, it's not Lazarus' house because he's being seated, or he's reclining around the table. Well, that you kind of would expect. But the note in John 2 about Martha was serving, That would be unusual to point that out if it was her own house. I mean, it'd be, you know, like say we invited everybody over to dinner and somebody said, and Linda was serving the meal. Well, why would you say that? I mean, of course she was. I mean, that's what you would normally expect within a person's own household. So putting this together, you find out, well, this Simon the leper was the one that hosted the party, and Lazarus is a guest of honor just like Jesus is. There's two guests of honor that day. And Martha, of course, she's, well, this is not surprising, what, Martha was the doer of the bunch. We know that. Martha was the gung-ho one. You saw her earlier in a deal where she doesn't come across well, but she's certainly seen as a productive, you know, person. Well, B, Jesus requisitions a young donkey and makes his entry into Jerusalem on Monday. Now, this had to be, again, fairly late in the day because it was only a 2-mile trip. And even assuming they had to stop and wait on the donkey or whatever else, this trip could have easily been accomplished within an hour, the whole thing. Now, that's not to say Jesus didn't take longer, but however long it wasn't very long. And the whole point is, this puts you late in the day, meaning that he didn't leave until late in the day. So he leaves the city as the darkness fell and returns to Bethany for the night. That's the passage we've just finished. See, on Tuesday morning, as Jesus and the apostles return to Jerusalem from Bethany, Jesus curses the fig tree. Now, I will continue to use the language of that, although Jesus never used like orkizo, the verb to curse, or orke, a curse. He didn't. That language is not used of this. But clearly, when he speaks against the fig tree, it's a judgment. I think because the fig tree withers, you can't view it as any other way. So I'll continue to use the language of cursing, even though Jesus didn't use it. Peter does. And rightly so, I think. So he spends the rest of the day in Jerusalem and departs for Bethany in the evening on both Tuesday and Wednesday. Now, we haven't looked at that yet, but in Mark 11, verse 19, and when evening came, they would go out of the city. And so what Mark's telling you is this is going to be his pattern all week. He does it on Monday, he does it on Tuesday, and he doesn't tell you again that he does it on Wednesday, but you probably could figure out that he did. So on the next morning, which is Wednesday, as they return to Jerusalem, the apostles noticed the withered fig tree. That's in verse 20. As they were passing by in the morning, they saw the fig tree withered from the roots up. And then it appears that it was on Wednesday that Judas finalized his arrangement with the religious leaders and began seeking for a time and place to betray Jesus. Now, again, Mark tells this portion of his story in a flashback because here we are, essentially, this is on Thursday, but Mark tells you he's back up one day to Wednesday. Now, the Passover and unleavened bread were 2 days away, and that's on Friday. So this puts you on Wednesday, if it's 2 days away. And the chief priests and scribes were seeking how to seize him by stealth and kill him. And they were saying, not during the festival, otherwise there might be a riot among the people. And then, verse 10, it doesn't tell you it's the same day, but it pretty much has to be. Then Judas the Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went off to the chief priests in order to betray him. So this deal was apparently made on Wednesday. And when they made the deal, the chief priests and all these people, they're not going to wait forever for Judas to do this. We've made the deal, we've paid you. And so very much within a period of probably no more than 24 to 36 hours, Judas fulfills his part of the bargain. And he does this on Thursday evening. So he made these arrangements in order to betray him. And they were glad when they heard this, and they promised to give him money. And he began seeking how to betray him at an opportune time. And guess what? His first opportunity comes the next night. So it doesn't take forever, as you might imagine. So he finalizes all of this to betray Jesus. Mark 14 advances the chronology to Thursday. Now, on the first day of unleavened bread, when the Passover lamb is being sacrificed, and we'll have to deal with that because of the reality of all of this, there were thousands, hundreds of thousands of lambs being sacrificed on this Passover. And there was only, I mean, if you were sacrificing a lamb every 10 seconds, let's say, and you have to do 100,000 of them, how long does that take? Well, that's a lot of time. Even if, you know, and it could have been given again how many ever families are injured, because you had to have a lamb for the entire family, one lamb per family. So if you've got, they say the population swelled to 2 million. Well, if you've got 700,000 or 800,000 families in Jerusalem, now you're talking about having to sacrifice endless amounts, well, almost endless from the human perspective, amounts of lambs. Well, that takes a lot of time. Well, what they did was they broke this into a two-day affair in order to accommodate. They didn't really have any choice because you couldn't sacrifice them all on one day. It wasn't even realistic. So Mark 14:12, on the first day of unleavened bread, his disciples said to him, "Where do you want us to go and prepare for you to eat the Passover?" And so they make preparations for celebrating the Passover in the upper room. And Jesus and the apostles eat the Passover meal after dark. Now that comes from John 13:1, that you don't get that. The sun has set. And so the sun is set, the gates are shut, and Jesus is in the city. This should probably tell you he's not leaving. And Judas figures this out at the Passover dinner, that Jesus isn't leaving. So Jesus is going to be in Jerusalem that night. Ha, ah, what better chance. Because he hadn't stayed in Jerusalem. And no doubt Judas told that. Well, Jesus doesn't stay in Jerusalem at night. You're never going to be able to arrest him because you're going to have to go all the way to Bethany to do this. And there was no way they would have wanted to take on that kind of exposure for their plan. I mean, if you're going to commit murder, you really don't want many more people knowing than is necessary. I would keep that one on the down low. If you're going to commit murder, I mean, I wouldn't tell anybody. odds are you'll get caught. John 13:1. Now, before the feast of the Passover, Jesus, knowing that his hour had come that he would depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own were in the world, he loved them to the end. And then we just get the fact that this is during supper. We're not told explicitly it's after dark, but it has to be after dark. The Passover meal was eaten around dusk, around dark. And so this is the point at which Judas gets ejected, essentially, from the group. This is the final deal where Jesus essentially tells him, go do what you're going to do. I know what you're going to do, now go do it. And the apostles still manifest that they're just completely oblivious to all this because they think, well, he must be sending them out to do something else. You know, they have no clue that Jesus is a betrayer. And even though, if you look ahead in verse 26, they were verse 24 actually, he's talking about betrayal in verse 21. In 24, Simon gestured to John and said, "Tell us of whom it is he's speaking." And now, why? Did were they all sitting there thinking, "Is it me? I mean, am I going to do this?" Which, if they were, that tells you how ragged their thinking was by that time. And leaning back on Jesus' bosom, he said, "Lord, who is it?" And Jesus answered, "This is the one for whom I will dip the morsel and give it to him." So when he dipped the morsel, he took it and gave it to Judas. Well, that seems pretty straightforward to us, but somehow the apostles didn't get it. They didn't look at it and say, well, Judas is going to betray him. And after the morsel, Satan entered in to him. See, that's one of the problems of being an unbeliever. You can be Satan-possessed. Now, they accused Jesus of this, but he wasn't, obviously. And Jesus said, "What you do, do quickly." Now, no one of those reclining at the table knew for what purpose he had said this to him. For some were supposing, because Judas had the money box, that Jesus was saying to him, "Buy the things we have need of for the feast," or else that he should give something to the poor. So after receiving the morsel, he went out immediately, and it was night. That's our proof text there. I mean, it doesn't say it in the earlier stage, but we're told that by the time they're eating dinner, it's dark. And Judas goes off into the darkness. Oh, how ironic. Oh, he was in the darkness in every way possible. Well, so Jesus is arrested on Thursday evening, subjected to a mock trial by the Sanhedrin, and delivered over to Pilate early on Friday morning. Mark 14:53, and we're not going to read this whole section other than the arrest actually occurs in verses 43 through 52. He was speaking, Judas, one of the 12, came up accompanied by a crowd with swords and clubs. who were from the chief priests, scribes, and the elders. And so, again, one of the things that's true here, and we'll see it all throughout in the book of Acts as well, or we have seen it, is that every segment of Judaism is indicted in this murder. It's not just the chief priests. It's not just the Sadducees. It's not just the scribes, the hitmen for the Pharisees. And it's not just the elders, the revered among the people, the rich and the elite, but they're all in on it. This was an organized plot to get rid of one person. And that's all it was. And so they arrest him, and they led Jesus away to the high priests. And all the chief priests and the elders and scribes. Now, why we have the third chief priest here? Well, an explanation there is that once you were in the office of chief priest, much like our president, you retained the title even after the fact. I mean, you'll still hear people call Clinton Mr. President. I seldom want to call our president president, let alone somebody like Clinton. But that title, you know, it tends to, people would use it after the fact. So that's why you have these chief priests rather than just a singular chief priest. There is a singular ruling chief priest. And we know that to be Caiaphas. So they lead him off, then they have this big mock trial, and in Mark 15:1, early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders and scribes and the whole council immediately held a consultation. And see, some of this was done without the knowledge of other people. For instance, I don't think Nicodemus was present at the arrest and everything that went on that night, but the next morning he would have been there probably, because he was a ruler of the Jews. But there's no indication that him and, say, maybe Joseph of Arimathea and some of these other people, there seemed to be these secret disciples even scattered among the leadership. But they weren't taking any stand for Jesus at all. They knew that they were risking their entire lives if they did that. So they weren't going to do it. They were spiritual cowards at some level. You have to just acknowledge that. That's just the way it is. And so, but now these people are drawn into this. The group that examines him that morning and the decision is made is a larger group than the select group of people that really were committed to his murder. Then they were present all the night before. So he's delivered over to Pilate early on Friday morning. So three, it seems likely that the group arose relatively early in the morning on Tuesday, probably leaving before breakfast with the intention of eating in Jerusalem. And they made the journey about 2 miles into Jerusalem. Again, if Jesus is in pretty good shape, this is only going to take about 30 minutes, 40 minutes maybe. And I think Jesus is in good shape. And it's early in the morning. Everybody's invigorated. Nothing like a nice walk before breakfast, right? Not me. I'm not a morning person. I wouldn't have wanted to do that. But that, again, they weren't long going into Jerusalem, and so the plan was most likely to get breakfast and eat in Jerusalem. Okay, well, our time's gone. We'll have to stop there, so we will continue on here on Tuesday. Thank God our air conditioning is fixed. And we will meet here on Tuesday. And remember, you're off Wednesday this week, so no class on Wednesday night. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your plan. May God the Holy Spirit enlighten us in Christ's name. Amen.